You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the programme, as the leader of Boko Haram has pledged allegiance to Islamic State, we ask if this is just a propaganda coup. Also ahead, does the European Union really need a common army?
But what Juncker is saying is for European credibility, we've got to substitute NATO.
Robert Fox there earlier today will be discussing what a European army can add to the EU's foreign policy. Plus, a key gas deal between Russia and China is set to be finalised, allowing President Putin to choose for the first time between exporting to Asia or Europe. All that, plus much, much more, as I'm joined by our guests today, Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton, with their take on the day's news. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 1800 hours. Well, let's look at a few of the headlines today so far. Vladimir Putin has admitted for the first time that the plan to annex Crimea was ordered weeks before the referendum on self-determination took place. Speaking in a forthcoming documentary, Putin said that he had called an all-night meeting on the 22nd of February last year to work out how to return Crimea to Russia. Also, a solar plane has completed its first leg of a round-the-world flight after landing in Oman a couple of hours ago. The Solar Impulse 2 will skip from continent to continent, crossing both the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans over the next 5 months. And finally, Venezuela will begin installing about 27,000 fingerprint scanners at supermarkets across the country to reduce food hoarding and panic buying, following the widespread shortages that have been seen in the country recently. Looking at the front pages, just briefly, the Sydney Morning Herald leads with Abbott Blasts UN. And it says a story here that Australians are sick of being lectured by the United Nations, according to Prime Minister Tony Abbott. And on The Age, a slightly less weighty story. Bugger Me, It's Bloody Gold is the headline. It's the story of a gentleman who has stumbled over a golden nugget, which is worth $135,000. Well, there you have it. That's the Australian front pages for you tomorrow. Well, joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of the China Dialogue. Welcome both to the programme as usual. Now, over the weekend, Abubakar Shekau, the leader of Nigeria's Islamist terror group Boko Haram, pledged the organisation's allegiance to Islamic State. The new alliance, which has been unilaterally declared, is unlikely to amount to much in terms of immediate collaboration. And as troops from Chad and Niger keep Boko Haram on the defensive, this weekend launching a joint offensive in Nigeria, we ask if this so-called alliance is more a propaganda move by the group. Isabel, let's start with you. Do you think it is just a piece of good PR from them? Because it's hard to see how they're going to be able to really kind of negotiate across. They're both slightly penned down and have got other business to get on with rather than kind of meeting in cafes to discuss how they might be friends.
Yes, well, you can see how it could be a propaganda move if ISIS accepts this kind of offer, which I think we don't know. We can only speculate what's in the mind. But you can lay out a scenario whereby this is good for both of them, because ISIS is, you know, trying to create this image of a global leadership in extreme jihadi violence. It has had pledges of allegiance from other groups lately across North Africa, far away as the Philippines. So adding to that, it adds to its global prestige. On the other hand, Boko Haram is under a lot of pressure. The African Union has decided to do something about it finally. So an alliance or an association with the kind of big global group might be seen to be good for its image. In practical terms, I mean, what can they really share? They can share, I suppose, intelligence. They can share an agenda. They can share training. They might share some sort of tactical advice. But they're not really going to be in the business of joint operations in any serious way. That shouldn't mean that it doesn't matter. I mean, if this really is an alliance, it is an alliance that, moves like this do create an impression and a lot of terror is about the way people feel about you as well as what you do.
Jane, both organisations are deeply rooted in place. You know, Boko Haram is very much an African movement and ISIS is very much an Arabic movement. Do you feel that that means that it would be quite hard for these two organisations to work collaboratively?
I think it's a dilemma for the Islamic State that the more you want to be a state on defined territory, the harder it is to be a global pan-Islamic movement when those territories are very far from their grand vision of being joined up. So right now in Iraq and Syria, ISIS is very focused on holding land and extracting money. There are international attempts to squeeze its finances, so it's really looking at ways to get money out of the local economy. And those sorts of concerns are going to be really specific to that territory, quite different from Boko Haram's. They might be able to learn from each other in terms of strategy. One of the things that Islamic State has been strong at has been its propaganda and its ability to make these videos and so forth. There might be learning and training that could be passed on in that sort of way. But I think when you're looking at the tactics and the local command and control, those are going to be quite localised. Indeed, it seems that in Iraq, they tend to use Iraqis in most of the senior positions. They're not as global as they would claim to be.
And it does seem to be that it's, you know, Boko Haram hitching its caravan, as it were, to ISIS. It doesn't feel like the relation, you know, they certainly seem like the weaker partner, don't they, Isabel?
They certainly do seem like the weaker partner, and IS hasn't actually, you know, publicly accepted this offer. So it might be that they find Boko Haram insufficiently worthy partners. Boko Haram has not shown a lot of talent or interest in governing the territories that it occupies in any creditable way. And I think that IS is certainly, you know, certainly extreme violence is part of it, but also the sense that, as Jane says, that they are a territory and they're building a caliphate. I'm not sure that they would necessarily see Boko Haram as a tremendous asset on that side of the equation.
Jane, do you think that's ultimately the weakness for IS? You know, that they are not just a terrorist organisation, that they want to hold territory, you know, they want to run towns, they want to be seen to be, you know, effective administrators to run their kind of education system. But they have, you know, the town of Raqqa, which seems a pretty grim place. But, you know, it's the holding on of that territory, which in the end makes them a bit of an easy target. As we're seeing in Tikrit, you know, they certainly have the Iraqi government hasn't been able to take that town yet. But in a way, you know, just the sheer numbers, over time, if you get organised, you will begin to take back territory from IS.
It creates vulnerabilities. And I think, although there's some talk from Western militaries about recapturing Mosul, I think there's also a hope among many Western government strategists that actually if Islamic State is contained, eventually it will degrade itself, that it won't be able to govern those territories effectively. However, that is obviously a big unknown. And one of the other issues they face in this kind of asymmetric warfare is that just being able to hold territory when you have tens of major countries and their armies rallying against you can make you look disproportionately powerful just by staying in place.
Well, we'll come back to that story more over the coming days, but we'll move on to our second story today. China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi announced on Sunday that the gas deal with Russia will be completed later this year. The agreement on a gas pipeline from Western Siberia will allow Vladimir Putin to choose between exporting gas to Asia or to Europe, and this is for the very first time. This is just another step for Russia as its economy keeps turning towards Asia and away from Europe. Also on Sunday, Wang Yi said that China plans to step up its trading volume with Russia, which may reach $100 billion in 2015, compared to $95.3 billion last year. Now, Isabel, we'll certainly come to you on this topic first. That doesn't seem like a huge jump in trading numbers. Has to be also to set that figure against what the trade is already for Russia with Europe, still, you know, far outweighed with what's happening in Europe. And in a way, this deal comes at the wrong time, doesn't it? You know, gas prices have gone down, oil prices have gone down, fuel isn't quite the bargaining chip it was. Do you feel it's a significant deal? Do you think it is a powerful, you know, diplomatic deal, or is it just a nice bit of economy going on the sides?
Well, I think it's convenient. It's both sides want to signal that they have each other, as it were. I mean, this gas deals have come in two stages. The first one was just after Russia took the Crimea, and sanctions came down. And it was a deal over the, earlier last year over the supply of gas to China, which had been stalled for many years over price. And suddenly the price came down. China got a bargain and Russia could say, we have an alternative market. And then there was a second deal, which was concluded around the time of APEC. From the Chinese perspective, they do need gas. They need gas that comes not through the Malacca Straits. They need gas that comes not through pipelines that go through uncertain territories. So it does suit them, and particularly in North China, where you have terrible air quality, which is because of coal-fired power stations, which has become a huge political issue. And it's quite difficult, actually, to resolve that. But even with these deals and with, you know, the anticipated increase in supply, you're only going to be, Russia will only be supplying 10% of China's gas needs by 2020. So it's not a game changer, but it is a comfort, as it were, to both sides.
Jane, what do you make of this deal? Do you feel, again, on this diplomatic issue, is it significant? You know, even then, when Isabel's talking about it, in a way, you think, well, if it helps kind of reduce, you know, the use of, you know, coal-fired power stations, maybe it's a good thing. Maybe it's not that significant. How much, we always read these deals in the context of, you know, Russia is trying to beat someone down. You know, is it really about Ukraine, this deal? Is it really about kind of snubbing the West? Or is it really just about ease of exporting, do you think?
There's a long-term economic logic to this, but it's been given more urgency by the politics. So if you look at many of the world's major oil exporters, including Saudi Arabia, they are directing more and more of their attention towards Asia in general, and specifically to China, because they think that's where the demand's going to be. Likewise, when you come to non-oil trade, the growth of the middle class in China is one of the major economic trends, you know, in the coming years. So it certainly makes sense for Russia, but it's probably a time where China can have the upper hand in any deal, because gas prices are low. You've seen demand for Russian gas exports to Europe fall. You've seen rising concern in Europe about the risk that Russia can use gas supplies for political leverage. I'm not sure they would be so keen to try that with China as they would be with smaller European countries.
Isabel, sorry for the shuffling of the papers, but I just wanted to pick up on a story which is actually on the front of the Los Angeles Times today, which is it says, China is cast as trade villain. It says, the Asian giant is seen as a major talking point as Obama seeks to win the passage of a Pacific Rim partnership. So this is trying to pull together some 14 countries around the Pacific Rim that make up 40% of the trade. Now, is it the likes of these deals in the end which, you know, forces China and Russia together? We can't see these things in isolation. You know, it is, you know, America and the West also have their bargaining games going on, that, you know, we're kind of, you know, forcing this marriage in some sense.
Well, that particular deal is an everyone but China set of arrangements as far as the US is diplomatic.
Yeah, deliberately excluded. Yeah.
Deliberately excluded, although what the Americans would say, well, you know, all they have to do is accept the rules and they will be welcome in the club. But it is all about the contest for influence, because China has been building up. I mean, China is now, for instance, the biggest trade partner of most Latin American countries. It lends more in, this is the US backyard, so it's lending more in Latin America than the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank combined. It has the upper hand trade-wise with almost all its neighbours, though many of its neighbours would rather be in a trade deal with the United States, which left them less dependent on China. So there is an awful lot of wider diplomacy going on, as you say. And the Russia-China thing, you know, they've had a very mixed history, Russia and China. We tend to think of them as natural allies because they're all both, you know, in formerly former communist, in one case still formerly communist state. But, you know, I remember the very bitter Sino-Soviet split in the 70s. They were not always friends. And these energy deals are certainly going to give China the upper hand, if you like. It's going to increase Russian dependency on China. And China has been nibbling its way through the former Soviet territories of Central Asia, building infrastructure, setting up trade deals. And it really is the beginning to dominate what was former Soviet territory. So I think that, you know, if I were Russia, I certainly need China, but I would also be rather wary.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we return, we'll assess what a joint army could do for the EU's foreign policy. And we'll also look at a canine murder mystery. But you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show.
I look at it and I think, God, could I have really lived like that? Could it have really been me? But I know that it was, so I do connect with it.
Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. It's 18:17 here in London. And still with me are our guests for today, Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton. Now, the European Union's foreign policy and security is once again making the headlines. According to Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission, a common army is necessary to legitimise how serious the EU stands to defend its values. But is this army really needed, in addition to the national armies of all the member states plus NATO? Well, the statement has been making waves throughout the European Union. Spokesman for the UK government has reiterated that the defence of a country is a national responsibility, whereas Germany's defence minister calls the European army the future and has backed Juncker's declarations. Jane, do we need it?
I find it hard to believe that we'll get it. I don't see the political will being there between so many member states. But there could be some benefits. NATO, for instance, has a lot of benefits in terms of sharing experiences, having a constant mixing between the armies of the different member states. Something like that for Europe could help to create a sense of European identity and shared defence interest that currently is lacking. I just can't foresee it in the coming years.
Isabel, do you think it could be a substitute for NATO?
Well, I'm with Jane on this one, honestly. I mean, this conversation is not entirely new. It's very hard to imagine a European army when you don't have a European foreign policy. You know, you cannot have an army which you direct against an agreed enemy unless you really share to a much greater degree than the European Union does a common vision of who the enemy is. You know, Poland's enemy is not necessarily France's or Britain's enemy.
But isn't that the same argument with NATO, in a sense? You know, that, you know, we have so many... NATO is such a broad alliance now, from Turkey all the way up to Estonia. Oh, do we all have the same shared enemies? Maybe, maybe not.
Well, I think that's true, but I think that NATO's been at it longer. And NATO doesn't include formerly neutral states like Ireland, for instance. I mean, NATO's the big inhibition on NATO in Europe. It used to be the French, but I think that has died away. But you know... Back in the 80s, there was a Franco-German division was talked about as a kind of step towards a European army to replace NATO, and it didn't really fly. So I think, as Jane said, you could argue for it, but it's not going to happen.
Jane.
You'd need to have a very limited mandate, I think, because for most countries, they would be very worried about the possibility of any situation where their troops could be committed to some kind of war that they didn't approve of. Maybe if you had an extremely limited mandate where people would only get involved in peacekeeping missions that had a UN cover or something like that, there might be more feasibility. But I just don't see, when you look across Europe and see so many of the major governments cutting defence spending, I don't see that there is support for a new military initiative of this kind.
And Jane, what do you think about, you know, what's strange is, in some senses, you know, that this has the full backing, or certainly some backing from the Germans. So what strikes me is, you know, that we're going through an interesting period of, you know, tit for tat, you know, we edge for a bit further forward than you with the Russians. Now, one of the things we know that the Russians have been very concerned about is being ring-fenced by alliances, by NATO, by the European Union. And Germany knows that, and Germany has in the past been the bridge with Moscow, kind of saying, look, don't worry about it, you know, we don't want that, we will kind of help you along this path. Now, here they are backing something which I'm sure would, if you were sitting in Moscow, you would think, hold on, here we go again. Here's another attempt to kind of surround us with you know, an opposition army.
I think there is a tendency in Moscow to think of such policies as being directed against them. I don't think it is. I think that it's in line with Germany having more of a vision for a Europe that's more closely united, and that they might argue that this would be something that would help Europe to develop a common foreign policy, and that's the road Europe should go down. But Germany itself is cutting defence spending. So again, I don't see that the German taxpayer would necessarily be keen on their troops being called up to causes that wasn't strictly in Germany's national interest.
Isabel, how effective do you think NATO is as an organisation? Now, we talked there about the kind of, you know, the stretch that it faces. And I guess what the Europeans are kind of answering to is a kind of feeling, I think there's some kind of nervousness if you're sitting in Tallinn or Riga or Vilnius or Warsaw. You're thinking, really, is this going to come good for me if there is an attack on one of us? You know, is the NATO alliance really strict and strong? Or if, you know, Russia took, you know, a few meters of Estonia, you know, would they say, actually, we're not going to come and fight for you? And I wonder if there's a sense that, you know, if it was a more tightly pulled together European army, that actually a response would be more likely.
I just can't see a European army being more tightly pulled together. You might find, you know, an army which was, you know, a British, French and German consortium might be able to act like that. But a wider European army under a mandate of what? The European Council? It's simply not going to do that. If I were a Baltic state worried about that, I would bet on NATO, quite honestly, at this point, because there is a common defence pact there. You know, if you're a NATO member, an attack on one is an attack on all. And there is a commitment, which I very much doubt that the Americans would abandon, particularly in the light of the last 18 months of Russian behaviour. I think that the bet would certainly be much stronger on NATO than it would be on any putative European defence.
Jane, is that your feeling? Is it like taking out two lots of insurance?
You could put it that way, yeah.
You've already got your travel insurance. Why do you want to take some more out of your bag?
Why do you want to pay twice over?
but just looking at that notion of, you know, why do you think there is this appetite? Why do you think Jean-Claude Juncker thinks that this is, you know, a good idea from the get-go?
I think it's part of a vision for Europe where the idea is that if European countries really pooled their resources, their diplomatic and military and economic resources, Europe would be a world superpower. You know, Europe accounts for about a third of defence spending outside the US, so it is spending more than China, it is spending more than Russia, if you put all the countries together. Individually, none of the countries can claim to be that strong, so the proponents of a more united Europe would make that argument. Many others just are not prepared to sacrifice the national sovereignty and national decision-making power that they currently enjoy.
You could only have to imagine how the political response within another European country of the death of a citizen or a soldier under the command of, what, a German general? I mean, it's unthinkable. Think of any of Southern Europe. Think of Britain. It simply wouldn't. It's politically, for me, politically very hard to imagine.
Now we're moving on to a very different topic for Midori House now, and we did promise you a canine murder mystery, and we're coming back to these shores and to Birmingham, where the dog show was of Crofts took place at the weekend. And there's been outrage expressed today as it became apparent that a competing dog has been poisoned and killed. The victim in question was a rather splendid Irish setter who went by the name of Jagger. Well, Jagger died shortly after returning home to Belgium after coming second in her class. As it emerged that another in her breed has also become violently ill, many asking who on earth would want to do such a terrible crime. Well, first of all, I don't know if any of you saw any of Crofts. I happened to catch some of it the weekend. First of all, I was intrigued that the dog that won, that Scotty, it was a good example of kind of global diplomacy. It was an American-born dog owned by a Russian. That was the kind of diplomacy, canine diplomacy, I could see.
Who knew?
Who knew?
And excuse me, with a Scottish national identity, which should not be forgotten.
It was kind of like Alex Salmond married with the Clintons meets Putin. Everyone was there together.
That sounds like a Tory party election campaign poster.
I think I missed the fine detail because I was so excited by the fact that scientists have discovered what kind of music cats like. So I just took my eye off Crofts for a minute.
What kind of music do cats like?
You can hear it, and CB. They don't like human music apparently, but the music that was played sounded rather like purring to me. So that figures, right?
And dogs like bark, of course. But sorry. No. But we will return just quickly on this. Why is it we're you're enamoured as soon as you talk about the cats? The dog season has been full on here. Is it just a light story? But we do see in those dog breeds, there was something about a bit of kind of national pride kind of trotting around. There was, there were the people who were supporting the Maltese and the Irish. Dogs are a bit of an expression of a national brand as well. Whenever you see a Shiba Ken, the little kind of Japanese dog in Japan, people are, they're proud of their little kind of Japanese dog. I have a very pugnacious English breed as a dog. But, do you think that dogs do say something about nations?
Well, it's great because they don't speak. You can read pretty much anything you like into them.
You've painted this rather like the Eurovision Song Contest of the canine world here,
There was some very kind of strange goings on apart from the murder.
But the murder is rather bizarre because if I had a rather beautiful champion dog, and it was a very handsome dog, I think it was a boy, by the way, I'm not sure that I would. And it was at Crofts. I mean, how did this poisoned meat get introduced into the dog? Because surely you hang on to your dog at Crofts. You're not going to allow any stranger to feed your dog. I simply can't imagine how this happened.
Yeah, so I don't know whether the person, because you do see pictures of people who are the owners kind of like snoozing in their kennels while it goes on. But there was another dog whose name was Sacha Baron Cohen, which was a very... Well, it was one of the winning breeds as well.
I think he should sue.
Get some royalties.
Well, I think we've probably said almost everything we can say about the worlds of dogs. But it was great to see, as we said, a Scotty dog who had come all the way from Russia. It was called From Russia with Love as well. It was even better than that. That was kind of good diplomacy. And this is the last pet plug. So you have a cat, Isabel?
I do have a cat, yes.
Name?
Name Nico, actually.
Nico, after the
named
singer.
By my daughter.
After the singer?
Very likely, yes.
Oh, good. And Jane?
Not currently. It's a topic of hot debate with my husband, which I will soon win.
Okay. But a cat will be returning.
It would be a cat. At least one cat.
Okay. Maybe several. We've been talking about whether we should do a pet podcast and whether we could do it a kind of bit more of an elevated level. I think we have like two kind of people here for a pet podcast who could come on and contribute greatly over the coming months. But we are going to have to leave it for there. Jane Kinnamont and Isabel Hilton, thank you very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House. And that's all we're going to have time for on today's show. Produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by David Pleasant and Kate Bullivant, and our studio manager was Weidong Lin. Now, for the next half an hour, Marcus Hippie is going to be bringing you lots of music. And then at 1900 hours, it's a culture show with Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. So stick around for that, for another dose of good news and comment from around the world. The show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.